The Federal News Update for Wednesday, December 17th, 2025, Evening Edition. Hello, and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Our mission today is, well, it's an exhaustive and incredibly detailed accounting of what the U.S. federal government has been doing. We're looking at a really intense 48-hour window starting back on the morning of December 16th.
And what emerges from this, you know, this snapshot is a government under enormous stress. It's really defined by this core conflict.
A conflict between what exactly?
You have this synchronized, really aggressive assertion of unilateral executive power. And it's running headlong into a deeply fractured and, I mean, frankly, a rebellious legislative branch.
That contrast really is the story of the week. And we are going to unpack it point by point for you. We're not just looking at the headlines here.
No, not at all. We are synthesizing the constitutional clashes, these sweeping new national security and immigration measures that are being implemented at lightning speed.
And crucially, we're going to detail the dramatic and, well, chaotic shifts impacting the federal workforce. And maybe most relevant to you, the listener, we're going to get into the cliffhanger around healthcare costs for millions of Americans right before the holidays.
It's a perfect storm of policy and politics.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Where do we begin? I think we have to start where the velocity is highest, the executive branch.
Absolutely. Over the last 2 days, the administration has made some truly extraordinary moves to consolidate power and really to fundamentally redefine how the United States approaches both its security and its sovereignty.
And this kicks off with the final formal transition of the entire military apparatus.
Yes, the Department of War. It is now officially the name of the military establishment. Now, the directive was announced a while back, but what we've seen in the last 48 hours is the implementation just accelerating from a policy goal into a concrete operational reality.
So this is really happening now on the ground.
It is. The executive mandate is absolute. Pete Hegseth is now officially referred to as the Secretary of War in all executive correspondence, all internal memos, and every public statement from the White House.
And you're saying this is more than just changing the name on the letterhead? The infrastructural shift is happening too?
It's complete. The digital transition has been executed. The domain, war.gov, is now live. All the digital assets, the seals, they've been redesigned. They're re-racing the Department of Defense logo to reflect that, you know, that pre-1947 lineage.
That feels like a massive undertaking from an institutional perspective. But the symbolic shift seems even more profound.
It is. I mean, the doctrinal implication here is immense. It signals a very conscious rejection of that post-World War II idea of a purely defensive posture.
And the president said as much, didn't he?
He did, explicitly. Stated that the name change signals a clear shift from passive defense to focusing on, and I'm quoting here, the willingness and availability to wage war to secure what is ours.
Secure what is ours. That language shift impacts everything, doesn't it? From budgets to diplomacy.
Everything. When you start talking about securing what is ours, you are moving away from alliances based on collective security and, you know, you're moving toward a more unilateral, more aggressive and forward-looking posture. It defines threats not just as things to be guarded against, but as things to be actively eliminated.
That focus on unilateral aggressive action is the perfect setup for the massive constitutional clash we saw unfold yesterday.
It is. And that clash centers entirely on military oversight, specifically around a deeply controversial incident that happened earlier this year.
The boat strike in the Caribbean.
Exactly. This is a major separation of powers fight. So the incident itself happened back on September 2nd, 2025. U.S. forces conducted a strike on a vessel they suspected was carrying drugs.
But the real controversy, the heart of the issue, stems from reports of a second strike.
That's right. Reports which, you know, the administration has not fully disproven, that a second strike was carried out that killed two survivors of the first attack. And that immediately raised grave questions from congressional investigators.
Questions about legality, I assume. Targeting individuals who were effectively out of the fight.
Precisely. Targeting individuals who may have been classified as hors de combat. That means they were out of the fight, incapable of resisting or posing a threat. It's a very serious allegation.
And that brings us to December 16th. Secretary Hegseth goes before the Senate, and the confrontation over the video footage of this incident was, well, it was immediate.
And absolute. He refused, point blank, to release the full, unedited video footage of that incident to the general public.
What was his justification for that refusal?
He asserted absolute executive privilege over military operations, citing, quote, long-standing Department of War policy. He made it very clear. He said, of course we're not going to release a top secret, full, unedited video of that to the general public.
But Congress has its own leverage here, right, in the defense bill.
They do. And this is key. The House-passed version of the NDAA, the defense bill, it contained language specifically threatening to withhold 25% of Hegseth's travel budget until that footage, and, just as important, the authorizing orders, are provided to the Armed Services Committees.
So doesn't withholding that video, I mean, regardless of whether the strike itself was legal, doesn't it just fuel the perception that the executive branch has something to hide? It feels like they're daring Congress to pull that funding.
They absolutely are. It is a direct challenge to the legislative branch's oversight function. A total power play.
So what happened after the public refusal? They had a closed-door session, I believe?
They did. Following that public confrontation, Hegseth and the Admiral, who actually ordered the strike Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, they appeared for a classified briefing where the video footage itself was screened for lawmakers.
And the political fallout from that was immediate.
And completely polarized. The reactions coming out of that classified room were deeply, deeply conflicting.
So tell us about that. What were the two sides saying?
Well, Republican senators generally came out backing Hegseth's decision to keep the video classified. They argued it was necessary to protect sources and methods, you know, the standard operational security line.
And the Democrats?
They were vocally demanding transparency for the American people. Senator Richard Blumenthal, for instance, came out and demanded the footage be released, stating flatly, I think they would be shocked.
Shocked. That's a powerful word.
It is. It's clear the issue of whether the U.S. killed survivors of a strike and the executive's right to conceal that evidence from the public is not going away. This constitutional crisis is only just beginning.
And this aggressive, forward-leaning posture isn't just about a political fight in Washington. It's actually driving escalating military operations on the ground.
Correct. And that dovetailed perfectly with the formal escalation of the counterterrorism mission right here in the Western Hemisphere.
Which brings us to the State Department.
Yes. On December 16th, the State Department, under Secretary Marco Rubio, executed a massive legal and geopolitical shift. They formally designated the Colombian paramilitary cartel, Clan del Golfo, as a foreign terrorist organization, an FTO.
An FTO designation. What's fascinating here is how that immediately, in the real world, changes everything. It transforms drug interdiction from, what, a law enforcement issue?
Into a full-scale counterterrorism operation backed by military force. The entire operational landscape for U.S. forces in Central and South America changes overnight.
So break that down for us. What are the immediate effects of labeling them a terrorist group?
The effects are multi-layered. First, it triggers legal mechanisms that freeze all of the group's U.S. assets.
Yeah.
And the assets of their affiliates. It's meant to disrupt their financial lifelines.
And the second layer?
Second, and this is broader, it criminalizes what's called material support for the group. And that casts a very wide legal net that can, you know, ensnare individuals or companies who might be unknowingly involved in their logistics or their financial laundering.
But there's a third geopolitical implication here, and it seems to be a direct challenge to Colombia's own government.
It is. This is the most disruptive part. It's a direct challenge to Colombian President Gustavo Petro's highly ambitious total peace policy. Petro is trying to get negotiated settlements with armed groups, including the Clan del Golfo.
And the U.S. designation effectively torpedoes that.
It makes it incredibly difficult. The USFTO designation effectively criminalizes any negotiations with a group that the U.S. now labels as terrorist. It severely complicates Colombia's sovereign domestic policy.
And we are seeing the aggressive military action to back this up right now.
We are. The U.S. Southern Command reported hitting three more alleged drug boats in the Eastern Pacific just in these last 48 hours. 8 people were killed.
And this is part of a much larger campaign.
A continuous, aggressive campaign since September. It brings the total to over 95 deaths and more than 20 destroyed boats. So the executive branch has used this window not just to rename its military, but to legally and operationally redefine what a national security target is in our hemisphere, and to use lethal force with high frequency.
That strong unilateral action was immediately mirrored in immigration policy with a sweeping new presidential proclamation on December 16th.
The travel ban expansion, yes.
Let's talk about that and how it's trying to close what the administration sees as administrative loopholes.
So the proclamation is titled, Restricting and Limiting the Entry of Foreign Nationals to Protect the Security of the United States. And it's a fundamental, extensive modification of the entire U.S. exclusionary framework. It imposes a categorical suspension of entry for both immigrants and non-immigrants, and it's effective January 1st, 2026.
The ban itself is expanding significantly, adding 7 new nations to the 12 that were already on the list.
That's right. The new additions are Burkina Faso, Laos, Mali, Niger, Sierra Leone, South Sudan, and Syria.
And the administration's stated rationale for this.
It's based on specific findings of, quote, demonstrated, persistent, and severe deficiencies in screening, vetting, and information sharing within these nations. But it's important to note the specific geopolitical context here.
Especially with the African nations.
Exactly. The inclusion of the Sahelian states, that's Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, is directly tied to the displacement of Western influence there by military juntas and Russian-affiliated groups, like the Wagner Group. The administration argues this makes effective, reliable security vetting impossible. It's a national security ban driven by geopolitical instability.
And here's where the proclamation gets, I would say, technically sophisticated. It's going after administrative loopholes and specific travel identities. It's moving beyond just a simple list of countries.
Yes. This deep dive into administrative vulnerabilities is really central to the proclamation's strategy. First, it makes a significant diplomatic move. It explicitly restricts entry for any individuals using travel documents issued or endorsed by the Palestinian Authority.
So by invalidating those documents for U.S. entry, what's the message there?
The message is that the administration is effectively derecognizing the PA's international travel legitimacy in the West Bank. It's a major diplomatic statement embedded in an immigration rule.
Beyond that, the White House cited specific findings of systemic fraud that informed the ban's structure. Can you detail those vulnerabilities for us?
They detailed 3 highly specific vulnerabilities they found. The first is what they call the widespread civil registry collapse in certain restricted countries. They noted that critical identity documents, things like birth and marriage certificates, are often handwritten on non-secure paper.
Which makes them easily forgeable.
Easily forgeable and essentially unverifiable by U.S. consular officers. The foundational data of identity verification is just completely unreliable.
Okay, what was the second vulnerability?
The second is what they termed institutionalized educational fraud. They specifically cited instances in an unnamed country where falsified college diplomas are being systemically used to get F1 student visas, and even to qualify for NCAA athletic scholarships. It's a direct vector for economic and identity fraud.
And then we have the strategy used by some nationals to essentially launder their identity to get around the ban. They call it the CBI loophole.
That's the third major target, the CBI loophole, or citizenship by investment. And identity laundering is the perfect way to describe it. Nationals from full ban countries were found to be purchasing passports from third-party nations, often small island countries that offer citizenship without a residency requirement, specifically to evade U.S. restrictions.
So how does the new rule stop that?
The new measures place partial restrictions on the countries that are facilitating this practice without adequate vetting. It aims to stop the use of these clean passports that were purchased specifically to defeat the spirit of the travel ban.
Finally, we have to look at the humanitarian side of this, the dramatic narrowing of exceptions. The new order is eliminating the broad categorical exceptions that existed in previous versions of these restrictions.
This is perhaps the most sharply criticized element of the whole proclamation. In the past, there were often automatic waivers granted for certain classes of individuals.
People like adoptees, immediate family members.
Right. Adoptees, immediate family members of U.S. citizens, and critically, Afghan special immigrant visa holders, our allies, the interpreters, the contractors. The new order removes all of those automatic protections. It forces all waivers to be processed on a rigorous case-by-case basis, and the burden of proof is entirely on the applicant.
What is the administration's stated justification for dismantling these automatic humanitarian protections? It seems incredibly harsh.
The justification they're giving is that familial ties have historically served as, quote, vectors for fraudulent, criminal, or even terrorist activity. They argue that a blanket exception is simply too vulnerable.
And the criticism has been swift.
It has. Advocacy groups like hashtag AfghaniVac have come out swinging, arguing the policy cruelly and unnecessarily strands U.S. allies in hostile territories. It forces them into these years-long, often futile, case-by-case vetting processes after they have already completed extensive security checks to get the SIV in the first place.
So the story of the executive branch over these last 2 days is just maximum authority, maximum velocity, asserted through military rebranding, geopolitical positioning, and these sweeping restrictions.
A single fast pen. While on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, the legislative branch is demonstrating its inability to even achieve consensus on life or death matters like health care.
Let's pivot now to Congress, because the situation there is far more chaotic.
The contrast is truly stark. On December 17th, the Senate did manage to achieve a moment of massive bipartisan consensus on defense policy. They gave final passage to the $901 billion National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2026.
And the vote was decisive.
Very decisive. 77-20. So this comprehensive defense policy package now heads to the president's desk. It really represents a moment of unity in an otherwise fractured Washington.
But while the NDAA codifies many of the administration's priorities, it also establishes some critical strategic guardrails. This is Congress trying to push back against some of those unilateral impulses.
It creates specific checks and balances. For instance, the bill mandates that U.S. troop levels in Europe must stay at a baseline of 76,000 unless NATO allies are formally consulted. That serves as a significant check against any rapid unilateral redeployment of troops the president might favor.
And it continues funding for Ukraine despite some opposition.
It does. Despite significant isolationist currents, you know, within the GOP base, the NDAA authorizes $800 million. That's split into $400 million annually for the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative through 2027. That ensures a continued flow of lethal aid deep into the next administration cycle.
Here's where the consensus meets technological and economic reality, the inclusion of the BioSecure Act. This feels like a massive quiet shift in U.S. economic policy.
It is a monumental step, a step toward decoupling critical U.S. supply chains from China. The BioSecure Act prohibits federal agencies, including the Department of War and the NIH, from contracting with biotechnology companies of concern.
And it names them specifically.
It explicitly targets the Chinese firms WuXi AppTec and BGI. The reasoning is directly linked to national security risks. The concern is these companies having access to the genetic and health data of U.S. service members and, really, the broader American population.
So what are the immediate real-world implications of this for, say, the pharmaceutical industry? This sounds disruptive.
It forces a massive, expensive, and time-consuming reorientation. It means any U.S. pharmaceutical company that works with the federal government must now immediately begin auditing its entire supply chain to ensure it doesn't rely on services from these Chinese firms.
And a company like WuXi AppTec is a huge player.
A massive contract research organization. Pulling away from them requires tens of billions of dollars in new investment, building out domestic capacity, and completely rerouting clinical trials and manufacturing logistics. The industry is already projecting multi-year delays in R&D as they scramble to comply.
Now let's look at the administration priorities that the NDAA did fully codify and fund.
Well, the bill fully implements numerous administration proposals that were central to their platform. It mandates the repeal of diversity, equity, and inclusion DEI offices and trainings across the Department of War. The House Armed Services Committee estimates that saves about $40 million.
And it also targets climate-related programs.
Yes, it eliminates climate change-related programs, cutting about $1.6 billion in funding. That's in line with the administration's focus on immediate mission readiness over long-term environmental planning. The bill also grants the president emergency military powers at the U.S. border, supporting that ongoing troop deployment we discussed earlier.
But perhaps the most surprising inclusion, showing a rare moment of genuine bipartisan reassertion of congressional authority, was the repeal of those old war authorizations.
That is historically significant.
Mm-hmm.
For decades, presidents of both parties have relied on those authorizations.
Mm.
The ones passed for the Gulf War in 91 and the Iraq War in 2003, to justify military actions all across the Middle East.
So why now? Why did Congress finally agree to take back this specific power?
Because the administration's aggressive new doctrine, that willingness to wage war, it spooked both sides. It made them realize they needed to draw a clear line around future conflicts. Repealing those decades-old authorizations, the AUMFs, sends a clear message that Congress must authorize any new major offensive actions regardless of who was in the White House.
So that's what made it through. But what got dropped from the bill is often just as revealing about what's really going on in Congress.
Yes, several critical, seemingly non-controversial provisions were stripped from the final NDAA package right before it passed. It really confirms the internal chaos.
Let's start with the practical one, the right to repair.
This was a widely supported measure. It would have allowed Department of War units and mechanics to fix their own specialized equipment tanks, aircraft parts, vehicles, instead of being forced to rely on often slow and very expensive private contractors. It was pulled from the final bill at the last minute.
And that sent shockwaves through the contracting world.
It did. It signals that the powerful defense contracting lobby successfully protected their exclusive maintenance revenue streams at the expense of military readiness and efficiency.
More concerning, though, are the quality of life reforms for junior service members and their families that were also dropped. Many of them are struggling with things like food insecurity.
This is where the lack of consensus shows its real human cost. Lawmakers rejected a provision that would have expanded the basic needs allowance, or BNA, eligibility by excluding the basic allowance for housing, the BAH, from income calculations.
What would that change have meant in practice?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office estimated this simple accounting change would have expanded BNA eligibility to roughly 61,000 service members and their families. People who currently struggle to put food on the table because their high rent, paid for by BAH, is counted as income and disqualifies them from aid.
So Congress decided that thousands of military families dealing with food insecurity just wasn't a priority. What else was dropped?
They also dropped a Senate pilot program for food coupons, specifically for junior enlisted service members. And they rejected lowering the threshold for temporary BAH increases in high-cost areas.
And what was the rationale given for dropping these?
Some lawmakers argued that existing efforts already provide a robust framework for assessing food insecurity, but the impact is clear. Congress chose to protect budget line items over providing immediate relief for the most vulnerable people in the military community.
We also need to revisit the flight safety clash around Reagan National Airport. The NDAA actually included a provision that directly undermines public safety efforts.
This specific provision allows the military to seek waivers to operate aircraft near Reagan National without broadcasting their location, using the ADS-B system. That's the Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast System.
A system that is fundamental to safety. It requires aircraft to constantly broadcast their location. So the NDAA provision allows military aircraft to fly dark.
Exactly. And this immediately drew sharp bipartisan criticism from Senators Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell, from the NTSB chairwoman Jennifer Homendy, and most powerfully, from victims' families of a recent crash.
They're arguing this undoes safety progress made after that tragic mid-air collision last January that killed 67 people.
They are. They point out that operating without a transponder flying dark was a central contributing factor in that crash. Senator Cruz publicly called the provision, quote, airdropped in at the last moment, and threatened to use his legislative muscle to address the risk.
And the legislative chaos here is perfectly illustrated by what happened next. Congress passed the defense bill with this high-risk measure, then immediately advanced a separate bill to fix the problem they just created.
It is the definition of legislative dysfunction. Despite the NDAA passing with this waiver provision, the Senate immediately advanced a separate measure, the Rotor Act, which aims to counter the new risk by requiring all aircraft, military, and civilian to broadcast their locations near that restricted airspace.
And the White House supports the fix.
The White House, the FAA, and the NTSB all support the Rotor Act. It's baffling governance. Pass the defense bill, create a safety risk, and then race to pass a second bill to mitigate the risk you just created.
That complexity and chaos spills directly into the most critical domestic issue facing millions of families, healthcare. This led directly to what's being called the House healthcare insurrection that happened yesterday.
This is the massive legislative headache staring Congress down. The impending expiration of the Affordable Care Act, the ACA Enhanced Premium Tax Credits, or APTCs, the deadline is December 31st, 2025.
And if Congress does nothing,
if they do absolutely nothing, between 20 and 24 million Americans who buy coverage through the exchanges will face soaring health insurance premiums. It is a massive affordability crisis starting January 1st.
And the divide in the House over solving this is just dramatic.
Absolutely. House Speaker Johnson initially ruled out a vote on any amendment that would extend these essential ACA subsidies. The Republican leadership was focused instead on their alternative plan, H.R. 6703, which centers on expanding health savings accounts.
Their argument being that their plan helps more people.
Right. They argue it lowers costs for all Americans, not just the 7% on the exchanges, and it saves the government money. But Democrats and critics countered that the GOP plan would inevitably increase the number of uninsured people because it lacks adequate subsidies for low and middle income families.
And the speaker's refusal to even hold a vote on the ACA extension is what triggered the rebellion from his own party.
This is a textbook example of a procedural revolt. Moderate Republicans join Democrats in a rare procedural move to force a vote on an ACA extension through what's called a discharge petition.
Can you explain what a discharge petition is for the listener?
Sure. It's essentially an emergency brake on leadership's control. It requires a majority of the House 218 signatures to bring a bill directly to the floor for a vote, completely bypassing the speaker and the committee process. And once they reached the necessary signatures, it created a serious internal fracture in the House GOP.
A remarkable display of political muscle by the moderate wing. They refused to let their constituents go over the cliff without a fight.
The frustration was palpable. Republican Representative Mike Lawler was particularly critical of his own leadership. He reportedly called the refusal to hold a vote absolute BS and forcefully told his colleagues to, quote, put the party crap aside and sign the damn discharge today. High drama.
So the discharge petition succeeded. Does that mean the crisis is averted? Are the subsidies safe?
Unfortunately, no. The current outlook, according to most political commentators, is that despite the procedural success, Congress is still highly likely to go over the cliff.
Why is that?
Because the petition got the signatures so late in the year. The actual House vote won't likely be scheduled until mid-January. This means a gap in coverage, where the subsidies expire on December 31st and premiums soar for a month or more, is virtually certain. They'll have to fix it. But the political damage from that temporary crisis will already be done.
Moving from healthcare paralysis to another highly charged partisan issue, the House passed a contentious bill on December 16th related to border security and child protection.
That was a passage of H.R. 4371, the Kayla Hamilton Act. It passed by a very narrow partisan margin of 215-209, and it addresses the screening and placement of unaccompanied alien children, or UACs.
What are the core requirements this act mandates for the screening process?
It mandates two core, very stringent actions for Health and Human Services. First, HHS has to contact the consulates of UAC's country of origin to request criminal records and background info before placing that child with a sponsor in the U.S.
And the second mandate?
The second mandates physical examinations of minors for evidence of gang affiliation, specifically including checks for gang-related tattoos. They cite MS-13 affiliation as a key concern to identify dangerous individuals who may be exploiting the system.
And this legislation immediately sparked intense controversy. How are the two sides framing their arguments?
The partisan chasm here is massive. Republican supporters argued the measure is essential to prevent placing dangerous individuals in U.S. communities. They cited the tragic death of Kayla Hamilton, who was allegedly killed by a UAC with known MS-13 gang tattoos and a criminal history. For them, it's about public safety.
And the Democratic opposition.
They argued the bill would endanger children fleeing persecution by requiring the U.S. to share sensitive data with the very governments they are fleeing from. They also condemned the mandate for physical examinations for tattoos as potentially abusive and an infringement on minors' rights and privacy.
This intense focus on the border mission leads us directly to the cost of using the military for immigration enforcement. A report released yesterday detailed just how much money has been diverted from the core mission of the new Department of War.
This report, from Democratic lawmakers, provides an exhaustive accounting. It found that the Pentagon diverted over $2 billion money that was intended for essential military readiness functions, like barracks repairs, schools, and training programs to support the southern border mission.
$2 billion is a staggering amount. Where were those cuts felt most acutely?
The cuts were extensive. We saw a massive $1 billion shifted from barracks repairs alone. So troops are living in increasingly dilapidated conditions because of this diversion. Other funds were diverted from an elementary school at Fort Knox, a medical facility at Naval Air Station Whidbey Island, and a jet training facility at Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi.
And where did that $2 billion actually go operationally?
The largest share, about $1.3 billion, was used to pay for the continuous deployment of troops to the southern border. The Pentagon's own data shows this operation was costing about $5.3 million per day.
Per day? That's incredible.
Beyond that, over $420 million was redirected to support detention operations on military installations like Fort Bliss in Texas. By September, that Fort Bliss facility was found to be in violation of at least 60 federal immigrant detention standards, highlighting a massive expenditure with very poor results.
The report also zeroed in on the highly inefficient use of military aircraft for deportations.
It did. It found at least $40.3 million was diverted to pay for military deportation flights. And this is financially absurd, because a military C-17 costs about $28,500 per hour to operate. A civilian flight contracted by DHS costs $8,500 per hour.
So they're paying more than three times as much to use military planes.
Exactly. And lawmakers noted that before this administration, military aircraft were almost never used for deportations. It suggests an expensive, politically motivated use of Department of War resources.
And the ultimate concern here isn't just the money, it's readiness. The diversion has a direct impact on the military's core combat mission.
They cited specific, elite units trained for combat, like the 10th Mountain Division and the 101st Airborne Division, the Army's only air assault division. These units are being diverted from their intended training cycles to perform border control duties. Lawmakers argue this severely puts readiness at risk for major national security missions.
Okay, we've covered the chaos in the House and the consensus in the Senate and the massive executive moves. Let's transition now to the federal workforce itself, where the courts and agencies are grappling with the impacts of all these changes.
And we start with a very significant victory for federal workers yesterday, December 17th. A federal judge in San Francisco, Judge Susan Ilston, indicated she will grant a preliminary injunction to reverse the terminations, the RIFs, of approximately 680 federal employees.
That's a huge victory. What was the specific legal basis for the union's challenge to these layoffs?
The legal argument centered on the stopgap spending bill that Congress passed to avoid a prior shutdown. That bill explicitly prohibited RIF reductions in force through January 30, 2026. The unions argued that agencies finalizing these layoffs during the recent shutdown violated that prohibition.
So this is a major check on the administration's ability to rapidly reshape the workforce.
It absolutely is. Judge Ilston noted that the chaotic nature of these RIFs have been continuing, suggesting the agencies had mishandled the whole process. The ruling was hailed by union leaders as another victory for federal employees and for the rule of law.
And this litigation is happening alongside some serious internal conflicts at agencies over healthcare and accommodation for the employees who are left.
Yes, and the CDC in particular is generating massive controversy over its new, highly centralized telework policy.
What's happening there?
This incident at the CDC perfectly illustrates the consequences of eliminating specialized HR functions. Supervisors were instructed to tell employees to email their personal medical documentation details about their need for telework due to health issues directly to Linda Chapman, the agency's chief operating officer.
Oh, wait, the COO. A non-medical administrator is reviewing private medical documents to evaluate health needs.
That is the crux of the controversy. The explicit purpose was to bypass the traditional, standardized, reasonable accommodation system. Employees are highly critical of using a non-medical COO to evaluate sensitive health needs, especially since the specialized RA staff and EEO offices were eliminated in the workforce reductions.
And what's the practical outcome for employees whose telework agreements are expiring?
They're forced to return to the office or use their own leave, even if it poses a health risk. And supervisors were specifically instructed to tell staff that these forced returns were not denials of accommodation, which employees called administrative deception.
And we know this policy is already causing serious harm, according to some senators.
Yes. Senate Democrats, in a formal letter, warned that the new policy will inflict outsized harm on workers with disabilities. They cited specific cases. One HHS employee with a high-risk pregnancy had her telework rescinded and was rushed to the emergency room on the day she was supposed to return.
That's horrifying.
Another case involved a disabled veteran whose PTSD was exacerbated by a shooting at CDC headquarters, only to have their necessary telework accommodation repeatedly denied and approved, and then denied again under this new centralized policy.
The NIH is also facing its own high-profile litigation from a former top scientist.
This is the lawsuit filed yesterday by Dr. Jean Marazzo, the former head of NIAA. She is suing the administration, claiming she was illegally fired in retaliation for whistleblowing.
What was the core of her grievance that led to her firing by HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.?
She challenged billions of dollars in abrupt, deep research cuts at the NIH that bypassed the standard scientific peer review funding process. She argued these drastic cuts endangered patients enrolled in active clinical trials affecting over 74,000 people and curtailed critical infectious disease and vaccine research. After she filed a whistleblower complaint, she was fired.
Let's pivot now to technology and talent. Despite all these departures and conflicts, the administration is trying to modernize the federal workforce, particularly in the tech sector.
This is where we see the focus on rebuilding through the Talent Pipeline Initiative, or the Tech Force. Federal CIO Greg Barbaccia has made fixing the government's ability to attract tech talent one of his top three priorities for 2026.
And what's the scale of this effort? How are they planning to attract talent away from the private sector?
The goal is ambitious: to hire 1,000 early career engineers specializing in AI, software, data science for 2-year stints across multiple agencies. And crucially, they're being brought in at high salary levels, GS-13 or GS-14, which is about $130,000 to $195,000. It's meant to be competitive with some private sector offers.
And there's also a new OPM rule to speed up hiring for critical roles.
Yes, on December 16th, OPM finalized a new rule to cut bureaucracy. It decentralizes the approval of waivers for large recruitment and relocation bonuses. Agencies can now approve incentives up to 50% of an employee's base salary themselves without waiting for OPM sign-off, which often caused them to lose out on top talent.
This emphasis on tech talent ties directly into federal acquisition strategy.
It does. GSA's OneGov strategy has already resulted in 15 enterprise-wide software contracts, using the government's massive purchasing power to get deep discounts. We know 43 agencies, for example, have already used these centralized contracts for AI tools. The push for 2026 is all about speed and efficiency in tech contracting.
And while agencies focus on high tech, even the U.S. Postal Service is looking to modernize its revenue streams.
On December 17th, the USPS announced a plan to open its last-mile delivery network to more shippers beyond Amazon and UPS. It's a key strategy to diversify and boost revenue by monetizing their existing, unrivaled network that delivers to over 170 million addresses. They expect to take bids in early 2026.
Finally, on technology governance, the OMB stepped in to set mandatory guardrails for AI tools used by the government.
This new OMB memo sets key procurement guardrails for agencies buying AI, effective March 11th. The most significant mandate is that agencies must update their policies to ensure that large language models, LLMs, that they purchase are demonstrably truth-seeking and ideologically neutral.
That directly tackles concerns about algorithmic bias and misinformation. What about transparency from the vendors?
Agencies must request specific data, including acceptable use policies and information about the model and data provenance, where the data came from. But, and this is a key limit, vendors are not required to disclose highly sensitive technical data like the actual model weights. It's a balance between accountability and protecting intellectual property.
Shifting gears now, let's look at the broader economic turbulence that defined these 48 hours, starting with the market's reaction to the administration's aggressive actions against Venezuela.
The energy market saw significant volatility. We saw WTI crude futures plunge below $55 a barrel on December 16th, a level not seen since 2021, before rebounding slightly to $56.65 on the 17th.
And that volatility dragged the energy sector down with it.
Yes. The S&P 500 energy sector dropped 2.3%. Major players like ExxonMobil and Chevron saw losses of 2.6% and 2% respectively, signaling a lot of investor nervousness about the stability of energy policy.
The overall market was also lower, but there was one significant IPO exception.
Stocks were down across the board, with the S&P down 0.7% and the NASDAQ down 1.1%, mostly due to skepticism about the AI trade. But the Medline IPO, a major medical supplies manufacturer, had a massive debut, trading up nearly 30% on a down day.
What does that tell you?
Analysts are interpreting it as a significant rotation by investors. They're moving away from speculative tech bets and toward profitable defensive healthcare plays that own their physical supply chains and rely on stable demand.
Speaking of the economy, the delayed jobs report came out yesterday, and it intensified the political battle over the word affordability.
Yes, the Labor Department released the delayed reports. They showed a loss of 105,000 jobs in October, which was attributed to federal worker departures from the mass buyouts, and then a gain of 64,000 jobs in November. Overall, the unemployment rate rose to 4.6%, the highest since 2021.
And the White House immediately used that data to defend their workforce reduction strategy.
National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett attributed the unemployment uptick directly to the 250,000 federal workers who took the buyout entering the labor force. He argued they'll find private sector jobs, claiming this is part of the goal to fire bureaucrats and hire these great Americans out here.
But the political tension around affordability is clearly dominating the messaging now.
The linguistic shift is remarkable. A year ago, Republicans campaigned relentlessly on inflation. Now, Democrats have successfully rebranded that problem as the issue of affordability, and it resonates deeply with consumers tired of persistent high costs for housing, food, and healthcare.
But the administration faces a strategic challenge because many of their key policies, The ones championed with such velocity are themselves inherently inflationary.
That is the economic reality they're grappling with. Policies like restricting immigration reduce the size of the low-wage workforce, which is pro-inflationary in sectors like agriculture. Tariffs act as a regressive tax on consumers. The White House chief of staff even admitted recently that the tariffs have been more painful than she expected.
Okay, we've covered the intense activity of the last 48 hours, but as the year closes, there are several major crises looming that will define the very beginning of 2026.
The first and most politically damaging is the ACA cliff. As we discussed, the virtual certainty is that those enhanced subsidies will expire on December 31st, creating an immediate healthcare crisis for millions of Americans starting January 1st. Congress will have to clean up the mess in the new year.
Then there's a perpetual threat to government functionality, the shutdown showdown.
We are rapidly approaching the January 30th funding deadline. Lawmakers have only passed 3 of the 12 appropriations bills. Given the poor morale among federal workers, another lapse is a high-stakes scenario that could cause major disruption.
And finally, there is the immediate non-legislative deadline related to transparency that promises to dominate headlines this weekend.
That is the court-mandated deadline for the full release of the Jeffrey Epstein files, scheduled for this Friday, December 19th. Lawmakers like Senator Amy Klobuchar are putting immense pressure on the administration for full transparency, stressing that the court order is a must, not a may. This will be an explosive news event.
What stands out to me across these 2 days is this incredible dichotomy in governance. The executive branch acting with maximum velocity, creating a Department of War, unilaterally reshaping immigration. Meanwhile, the legislative branch is defined by maximal fracture beset by internal revolt over basic things like healthcare.
That is the crucial observation. This institutional imbalance isn't just political theater. It affects the country's resiliency. When the executive branch defines its mission through rapid aggressive action, and the legislative branch is characterized by internal rebellion and the inability to meet crucial deadlines, like the ACA cliff, it inherently compromises the stability and effectiveness of governance itself.
So as we approach these massive fiscal and political deadlines of early 2026, the question for you, the listener, to consider is, what does this institutional imbalance mean for the resiliency of the American system?
Can a government function effectively when one branch acts as a lightning bolt and the other acts as a broken dam? That's a question worth mulling over.
This has been an exhaustive deep dive into a very busy 48 hours in the federal government. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.